TireRack.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to talk with one of the most progressive members of the state legislature about the session that just ended, and then later on we'll open up the phone lines. This is Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Well, as a longtime Tallahassee reporter Lloyd Dunkelberger wrote on the Florida Phoenix website yesterday, Florida lawmakers passed a $91.1 billion state budget on Saturday, ending the annual session that was dominated by a conservative Republican agenda. The legislature used the 61-day session to crack down on undocumented immigrants. Lawmakers erected new barriers for felons seeking the right to vote under Constitutional Amendment 4 that was approved by voters last year. The legislature endorsed arming teachers in school classrooms. Lawmakers backed the expansion of publicly funded vouchers to send more students to private schools using tax dollars. They passed measures to restrict local government rights and foist new mandated costs onto local governments. In a late-night move on Friday, the legislature approved a measure to make it more difficult and costly for citizens to collect voter signatures to get state constitutional amendments on the ballot. That law could impact current amendment drives for 2020. And among the amendment drives, seeking a ban on assault weapons, expanding Medicaid, and raising the minimum wage eventually to $15 an hour by the year 2026. Here to talk about the legislative session that just ended is Anna Escamani, who is a Democratic first-term state representative from Orlando. Anna Escamani, welcome to WMNF.
Thanks, Rob. It's really great to be here.
All right, the session is over. What did you think overall about the session?
Well, I definitely think democracy died a little throughout the 60 days. I mean, we passed some really terrible bills for the state of Florida, bills that I fought really hard against. And whether it was asking questions, debating on the House floor, filing amendments, you know, we did our part to like delay and amend these bills. But at the end of the day, the policies going to the governor's desk are pretty dangerous for the state of Florida.
All right. So if there are some dangerous bills, could you name the top three most dangerous bills going to the governor's desk?
Absolutely. I mean, the first one that is physically dangerous is Army teachers. And so we passed legislation that would allow counties to actually open up the guarding program to teachers, to allow teachers to be armed in the classroom. The Amendment 4 implementing bill, which I call interference bill, is dangerous because it goes against the will of the voters and makes the process to registration much more difficult. And then kind of a tie between expansion of the voucher system alongside sanctuary cities. You know, the voucher system would is taking away money from public education, traditional public schools, and putting it towards a voucher system for private schools. And then the sanctuary city legislation really creates a hostile environment for immigrant communities and is also just unnecessary because there are no sanctuary cities in Florida.
Going back to the Amendment 4, I think changing, you might say, changing the will of the voters. I don't know. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Do you think that the changes that were passed by the legislature amount to a poll tax?
I do. I mean, I mentioned on the House floor how we're creating a two-tier system, you know, one where it's defined by wealth. And so either you can afford, you know, the process of paying back your court fees and other restitution that we're defining restitution, or you don't. And there was an amendment that explicitly defined community service as a means to pay back those fees, which I asked the bill sponsor, are you concerned that a working class Floridian who's already struggling to pay back these fees but is in the process of doing so, where will they find the time to donate to community service when they're working full-time, trying to support their family and live that wholehearted life as hopefully voting citizen again? And he said he had absolutely no concern. So I think it just speaks to, you know, a disconnect from reality for those who are directly impacted, you know, by our judicial system. And at the same time, Rob, we are reforming criminal justice in Florida. We passed a bill. It's not the most robust bill when it comes to criminal justice reform, but it does increase thresholds and has some mandatory reporting reform. Why are we sending why are we sending Floridians back to a broken court system that was a disservice to them in the beginning? And that's exactly what we're doing with this Amendment 4 implementing bill, alongside requiring that before you can even register a vote, you have to have these fees paid. And so it really is not only an insult to what the voters decided in the last election cycle, but it's a deep disservice to the notion of second chances.
When you say broken court system, what do you mean by that?
We have a judicial system that overarchingly, detrimentally impacts those who are low income and those who are people of color. We know that when it comes to, especially you look at just rates around juvenile arrests, how though in our schools, the majority of our students are white, those who are arrested, majority are kids of color. And so the unfortunate reality is that we have, for a long time, a criminal justice system that disproportionately impacts low-income people and people of color when it comes to just arrest rates, let alone now creating the output of majority of people of color being the ones that are going to face the process of incarceration. And it's just a notion of fact. I mean, these are the statistics in front of us. And the problem is so serious that as a legislative body, we decided to change it. And so as we pass legislation on criminal justice reform, it almost seems ironic to me that we would, pass an Amendment 4 bill that feeds into that broken system that we just reformed. And, it really is just, I call an ideology of convenience where, you feel one way one day and a different way the other. But unfortunately, those who are going to lose at the end of the day are Floridians.
Our guest is State Representative Ana Escamani from Orlando. She's a Democrat. She's a freshman, first time in the legislature. We're talking about the just completed session of the legislature. If you were to grade this in terms of what were conservatives able to win and what were progressives and liberals able to win in this session of the legislature on a scale of 100, with 100 being conservatives getting practically everything they wanted and zero being progressives getting everything they wanted, how would you rate this session?
Yeah, I mean, it's about 110%. This really was a victory dance, I think, for my Republican colleagues, who I have utmost respect for. I mean, they're really good people in the legislature, but unfortunately, we disagree on values to an extreme degree. And I would say that when it comes to the conservative wish list, it was granted. I mean, even to the point that former Governor Jeb Bush was on the House floor when the voucher school bill passed. I mean, it was almost a throwback to years prior when it came to the aspirations and the celebrations. And so, I definitely left session, feeling disappointed, but also there's the saying that when the going gets tough, the tough gets tougher. And I think that as Democrats in Florida, we have to maintain that sense of resilience, because at the end of the day, change doesn't happen overnight. Change happens with a consistent persistence for something greater than ourselves. And we have to maintain that focus if we're ever going to see a balance in the Florida legislature and see bills that move on merit and not on party leadership.
A lot of people ask me, they say, look, if in the state of Florida, about 45% of the voters are registered Democrat, maybe 42% of the voters are registered Republicans, the rest are independent or non-party affiliate, but that number is growing every year. But they ask me, well, why do Republicans, and for the last 20 years, why have Republicans had such a success rate in Tallahassee? Why do they keep winning over and over again when it comes to their issues?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that gerrymandering is still a concern when it comes to our Florida House seats. Listeners might remember that there was a major lawsuit challenging the seats for congressional races alongside Senate races, but there was no lawsuit challenging the House seats. So at this point, Florida House seats, the original drafted lines have never changed post the last U.S. Census. So one thing I will say is that looking towards the next U.S. Census and the next redistricting, that everyone has to be on guard to make sure that we draw seats that fit the Fair Amendment policies that we passed under the Constitution several years ago. I think it was Amendment 4 and 6. Because right now, as an example, my seat is drawn to be a swing seat. I'm surrounded by Democratic seats, but mine in particular was drawn to make it more difficult for Democrats to win. Now, we won overwhelmingly, but that was only because of a lot of hard work and a lot of resources. And that's the other part, Rob, is on our campaign, we raised over $500,000. We knocked down 50,000 doors. We had 600 volunteers. That's an infrastructure that many Democrats don't have. And I coach Democrats across the state on how to raise money from a grassroots perspective. You know, what does it take to win in the field? Because if you're going to look at the amount of money available to both parties, you will always be outspent as a Democrat. This past election cycle, the Republican Party of Florida was literally able to give $50,000 gifts to their candidates. Just $50,000 from the beginning. Use it how you want to. That does not happen for Democratic candidates. So there is a lack of resources. There's a lack of mentorship when it comes to building a bench, which are all areas that me, as a first-time candidate, as a young person, as someone who comes from humble beginnings, who ran a grassroots campaign, I try really hard to teach these skills to others, because I don't think we're going to see a change in the state unless we can speak to the values of our community, and that means not falling into the needs of our corporate interests or sacrificing your values. It means being your authentic self and running a campaign that reflects the needs of your community and no one else's.
The governor promised at the beginning of the session, before the session started, that he wanted to see more money devoted to environmental protection. Did the legislature follow through with the governor's request?
Yes, we did deliver on water funding, Rob. There's been a huge increase in funding for efforts of water treatment and water research because of red tide and blue-green algae. That crisis hitting the state definitely elevated the need to put more funding towards water conservation and water treatment. What I will say is that we did not fully fund Florida Forever. Those funds were swept. And at the same time, not one environmental policy bill passed. So there were a few bills moved through the process. One that would have reset septic tank regulations to a point previously in our legislature. We had weakened the regulations. We were going to bring them back up. And then there's also legislation to create fees for municipalities that had any type of sewage leak. And I want to see that actually expanded to private sector as well. But either way, none of those bills passed. And we have filed 100% renewable energy goals bill for Florida to be based on 100% renewable energy by 2050. And our legislation never got one hearing either. So going into next legislative session, I'm committed to making sure that we actually pass some environmental policies, not just the funding piece, because funding can manage the crisis in short term, but we need long-term policies to actually prevent crisis in the future and also combat climate change, build resiliency, and do our part to make sure the state is here for generations to come.
We're talking with State Representative Ana Escamani. She's from Orlando. She's a Democrat. This is her first term in the state legislature. Ana, your background is you're a leader in Planned Parenthood, and two of the issues regarding abortion failed in this legislature, a very strong fetal heartbeat anti-abortion law, and also a parental consent law for teenagers before they could get an abortion. What do you make of the failure of those two issues, given the fact that the legislature is dominated by Republicans?
I really appreciate that question, Rob. And not only is the legislature dominated by Republicans, but we have a conservative state Supreme Court now, which is an environment that many of my colleagues want to test bills in, which is, I think, one reason why we passed so many conservative bills this session, is that there will be lawsuits and they will go to the courts and we'll see what happens in that environment. Regarding access to a safe legal abortion across the country, we're seeing some really restrictive bills being passed, including the 6-week abortion ban alongside others. In Florida, I think it's a pretty strong reflection of public opinion. Majority of Americans do support access to a safe and legal abortion. Majority of Americans don't want politicians to interfere in that decision. And so despite the climate around us, the fact that the Senate did not move the parental consent bill forward, I think, is a reflection of how there was a lack of a desire to debate bills that are likely unconstitutional. And even on the House side, we had a 3.5-hour debate on this legislation, and we did our part to really highlight how unnecessary legislation around restricting abortion is in our state, alongside how burdensome these laws can be for some of our most marginalized and vulnerable community members. And I was honored to help lead the charge on that fight and to do our part to paint the nuanced picture that abortion really is. Because no matter who you are or what your background is, we can all agree that abortion should remain a safe and legal medical procedure and decision made between a woman, her family, her doctor, and her faith. And if she's making a decision about her pregnancy, whether it's to terminate her pregnancy, raise a child, or choose adoption, that we want her to make that decision with all the information in front of her, with no judgment and no shame. And I'm hopeful that those values will resonate for future sessions and we can do our part to make life better for women and girls, not worse.
Representative Eskamani, I want to ask you about petition drives and amending the state constitution. There were several issues in Tallahassee the last 2 months to try to make it harder to amend the constitution. Were they successful? Is the legislature going to make it harder to amend the constitution? And what do you think about that?
Unfortunately, they were successful. It was a last minute effort by our Republican colleagues to pass these bills. In particular, they passed legislation that completely reforms the citizen-led ballot amendment process, making it much more difficult and much more burdensome. And I'm personally to say this, but they were inspired by this idea from Orange County, because here in Orange County, there was an effort to make it more difficult to do charter amendments years ago. And so those ideas inspired the bill we have now in Tallahassee. And it makes the process much more difficult, especially for any paid petition gathering operation. And it is explicitly designed to make it more difficult to have citizen-led ballot amendments. And listeners might remember, we would not have medical cannabis in Florida. We would not have conservation funds. We would not have so many issues if it wasn't for, including Amendment 4, right to restoration, if it wasn't for citizen-led ballot amendments. And right now, as we speak, we have a Medicaid expansion campaign. We have a $50 minimum wage campaign. We have an effort to deregulate investor-owned utility companies. These are all ballot amendments moving through the process that the legislature is scared of. And it's not just my Republican colleagues. It's also their donors. It's the business community, the large business community, like Associated Industries of Florida, like the Florida Chamber, who don't like to see these citizen-led ballot amendments happen because they're very expensive to combat and they're also very expensive to lead on. And they would rather spend their money on political gifts to candidates than on these large statewide campaigns. And unfortunately, that was one of the many bills that passed, and it's going to the governor's desk. And of course, we're encouraging the governor to veto this bill alongside many others.
On Eskamani, I saw that a quote from you saying that you were critical of some of the Democratic leadership there in Tallahassee, that they have a get-along, go-along mentality. Do you want to elaborate on that, or what do you think of the Democratic leadership there in the legislature?
Yeah, happy to. I come from a space of grassroots, a space where I honor transparency and I honor ethics and I honor the values of the Democratic Party. And I build bridges when I can, but I always hold people accountable when I must. And there was more than one occasion within our Democratic caucus where we rolled over. In particular, we would roll bills, which basically means we would ask questions on bills and debate them on the same day. And there could be, some intent for that. Maybe some deal was cut. I will never know, to be honest. But at the end of the day, when you expedite the legislative process, it gives your colleagues more time to hear more bad bills. Now, you can also argue that it gives more time for Democratic bills to be heard. But at the end of the day, when you look at the ratio of how many Democratic bills even moved compared to Republican bills, it becomes pretty clear of who's going to win that game at the end of the day. And I was the only Democrat to vote no on some bills. I was one of the few Democrats to vote a no, as another example, against a major telecommunication bill that preempts home rule. I was one of the only Democrats to vote against legislation that would give power to investor-owned utilities to increase their rates for undergrounding, even if there's no indication that they're actually performing undergrounding in your community. And so, for a lot of Democrats, it can be hard to make those decisions because they're funded by these same utilities that want to have policy that benefits their bottom line. And I don't subscribe to that approach. And that's why I run a grassroots campaign. It's why I'm I'm not scared to call out special interests when they can do better. And that's the type of Democratic Party that I want to see, and that's the one that I aspire to model. But I know it's easier for me than others because of type of campaign that I ran and just my background advocacy. So I have empathy for my colleagues who maybe don't feel that they can be as vocal. But when you're the loyal opposition, all you have are your values. And so I want to make sure that Florida voters know that when they think about Democrat and Republican, they realize there's a difference. And if we can't model a difference, then why would they vote Democrat in the future?
Representative, what do you think the most surprising thing for folks that have never been up to the session in Tallahassee, what do you think the folks would be most surprised at learning about the way Tallahassee works when the legislature is in session?
Two things. One is the fact that the system is very much led by special interests. I mean, and I just gave an example, with the last question, but lobbyists are very influential in the process. These are lobbyists who they're part of organizations that also make huge political contributions during the campaign cycle. So though you're not supposed to be discussing that while you're in the legislature, it's always kind of the aura, around us, that if I vote a certain way, it might hurt me in my election. So that culture and that mentality is ever present, though, again, I think it's important that we push back and redefine that process. The other part that I think is really surprising and I'm really grateful for, to be honest, is the sense of collegiality. And, I've had my ups and downs when it comes to building relationships with folks across the aisle and folks in my caucus. We're all learning and growing at the same time. But what I will say is that there is a sense of respect for one another, even when we might disagree on approach and disagree on values and disagree on issues. There is a sense of respect. And I think that's really important to maintain. You want to be able to, swing a punch and then a metaphorical punch, of course, and then, hug that person later, right? Because in the day, there's 120 of us on the floor. We all care about Florida. We just have different approaches to displaying that affection. And I have nothing but respect for my colleagues, and I'm hopeful that, we can work together to pass some common sense legislation that doesn't just lean one way on the political spectrum. And we can only do that through building relationships and having empathy for one another. And two, some of my Republican colleagues, there were Republicans who voted against Army teachers, who voted against sanctuary cities, who voted against the abortion restriction. So, there are some small victories there that I'm always grateful for.
And Representative, is there anything else that you'd like to add to this discussion? We went through a lot of the issues quickly, and there's so many more issues, but is there anything else you'd like to point out or add?
Well, I just want to encourage all of our listeners to stay engaged. We need you to call your lawmakers, email your lawmakers. Everyone's back in the district right now, so set up meetings with your local State House representatives. Talk to them. Share your issues. If any of these bills, if you don't like any of these bills, call the governor's office and ask them to veto. Now's the time to lead on veto efforts. And of course, 2020 is right around the corner. So if you're not running for office, consider it and consider helping your local candidates and elected officials that you do like, because it's all hands on deck for 2020.
All right. So it's not too late to maybe put some pressure on your member of the legislature to ask them to maybe pass up the word to veto a piece of legislation.
You got it. Yeah, now's the time. And we'll be back in session starting in September. So it's also the time to, again, communicate your values to your lawmaker and follow them during session and make sure they do what they're told to do by their constituents.
All right. Well, the next session is coming right up because we're in an election year next year, right?
You got it. Yeah. You got it. The session officially starts in January, but we'll be back in Tallahassee for committee meetings in September.
All right. Well, Anna Eskamani, thank you for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here.
It's an honor. Thanks so much.
That is State Representative Anna Eskamani. She's a Democrat. She's in her first term. She represents part of the Orlando area, and I spoke with her earlier today. Well, if you want to comment about the state legislature, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. And you can also send in an email to the studio here. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. There's a pretty good list of some of the measures that were passed and not passed by this session of the legislature, the one that just ended on Saturday. There's a pretty good list of what passed and what didn't pass on page 9A of the Tampa Bay Times. And we can open up the phone lines in a moment and maybe take your phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Well, I'm going to mention some other things, too, that we could talk about. There's a protest that's scheduled for this afternoon in Tampa in front of the school board offices on East Kennedy Boulevard from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. It's to protest possible privatization of some of the jobs within the Hillsborough school system. So that protest is going on this afternoon. Sean Canan is going to have a report about that. The protest at 3:30 this afternoon. The sudden White House announcement that a U.S. aircraft carrier and a bomber wing would be deployed to the Persian Gulf to counter Iran comes just days ahead of the one-year anniversary of President Trump's decision to withdraw America from the Tehran nuclear deal. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is said to be planning a speech tomorrow on the anniversary to discuss the next steps that his country will take. The United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency says Iran has continued to comply with the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal, which saw it limit its enrichment of uranium in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions. But American sanctions have wreaked havoc on Iran's economy, while promised help from European partners in the deal has not alleviated the pain in the country of Iran. We heard a discussion about that this morning on Democracy Now! If you want to comment, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has made it official. The administration will not be turning President Trump's tax returns over to the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. Mnuchin tells the Ways and Means Committee Chair Richard Neal that the committee's request lacks a legitimate legislative purpose. The move, which was expected, is sure to set in motion a court battle over Trump's tax returns. Chair of the committee, Neal, originally demanded access to Trump's tax returns last month under a law that says that the IRS shall furnish the returns of any taxpayer to top lawmakers. Well, hundreds of former federal prosecutors have signed onto a letter saying that President Trump would have been charged with obstruction of justice if he were anyone other than the president. The letter was signed by former Justice Department prosecutors who served under both Democratic and Republican administrations, including ex-U.S. attorneys and public corruption trial lawyers. The letters, about 500 of them, were posted on the website Medium.com. The number of signatories was about 500 this morning. It's expected to rise. And we're going to talk more about the possible obstruction of justice charges, too, with some news from Washington about what Mitch McConnell is about to say. Voters in Denver could make that city the first U.S. city to decriminalize the use of psilocybin. That's the psychoactive substance in magic mushrooms. Citizens Initiative is on the ballot today in Denver, and it's following the same tack that was taken by cannabis activists in Denver to decriminalize pot possession in 2012. Psilocybin has been outlawed in the U.S. since the 1960s, when it was widely seen as a recreational drug. Well, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee says he has no choice but to begin proceedings to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress. New York Democrat Gerald Nadler cites Barr's failure to comply with a subpoena to provide the full text of the special counsel's report on the Russia probe by Monday's deadline. That was yesterday. Nadler has scheduled the committee vote for tomorrow. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Speaking of the Mueller report, this news, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is declaring case closed on the Russia probe and potential obstruction by President Trump. The Republican leader, in his most significant public comments yet on the investigation, is expected to outline later today in a speech how Special Counsel Robert Mueller's exhaustive probe went on for 2 years and is now complete. The remarks are being billed as his final thoughts on the topic. Republicans taking their cues from Trump are eager to push past the investigation as Democrats are pressing for further oversight of the White House and the president's handling of the Mueller probe. Today, House Democrats are set to meet with Attorney General Barr as they negotiate to see a full, unredacted Mueller report. The House Judiciary Committee is poised to vote to hold Barr in contempt, as I mentioned before, over the Justice Department's failure to comply with the subpoena to turn over the report and its underlying documents. That vote could happen tomorrow. It's the opening salvo in what could be a lengthy, acrimonious court battle between House Democrats and the Trump administration over the Mueller report. And Let's open up the phone lines and take some phone calls. These are all important topics. Mueller's report, by the way, is now a bestseller, even in redacted form. It states that his investigation could not establish a criminal conspiracy between the Trump team and Russia. However, it did not reach a conclusion on whether Trump obstructed justice. Mueller didn't charge Trump, but wrote that he could not exonerate Trump either. House Judiciary Democrats say Congress is the only body able to hold the president accountable since the Justice Department has a policy against indicting a sitting president. All right, let's take some phone calls. You're listening to 88.5 FM, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And let's go to Gary in Dunedin. Gary, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. First of all, thank you for those great questions for one of the few progressives in the Florida legislature. Good interview. Real good.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, man. So I'm trying to figure out an analogy for the times we live in. It's like our country, maybe even the whole world, is like the Titanic. After the icebergs were hit, and they know the boat is sinking, and people aren't talking about the sinking much or getting on the lifeboats. They're talking about whether the deck chairs will fall this way or whether the band will play this song or that. We've got two, like, world-ending crises going on at one time. And I remember when Nixon was stonewalling Congress, defying subpoenas, et cetera. It was headline news on every media outlet. It was the only topic of discussion because people understood news priority, that we have a constitutional crisis. We have a president who wants to be king. This is the first thing we have to talk about and the last thing we have to talk about. We need to get this guy out of here. And the American people, many of them, went out in the streets. Some blockaded the White House and held Nixon prisoner and drove the message home to him that he needs to resign, and he did. And then, along with our constitutional crisis of Trump being way worse than Nixon, we have the reports continually coming out that anthropogenic mass extinction is happening right now. As the report yesterday, like, we are going to lose our entire biosphere, which provides an oxygenated atmosphere, oceans that have life in them, a lot sooner than anyone expected, and we're in the middle of it right now. But yet, the headlines and the discussions and people's conversation over the water cooler are about every other topic, and we're not looking at the sinking Titanic. I just wonder, what psychological thing is it that makes us not understand? And especially Nadler and Pelosi, should we impeach? Should we hold Barr accountable? Do you even have to ask? It's bizarre. What do you think?
Well, what do you think about Mitch McConnell saying that the case is closed on the Mueller report?
Right. I mean, what do we have now except a situation? I remember reading the history of before the 1776 Revolution, and Jefferson and Adams and them didn't want a bloody war, but they said, hey, look, we've talked to the king and his representatives over and over, but they don't care about us. They're just going to keep on doing the bad things they do. We're going to have to do something more than just talk. Now, I'm not suggesting a second American Revolution against Trump and the GOP, but it seems like the media is normalizing this constitutional crisis by not making it headline news everywhere all the time. And also, the environmental crisis, it's not just climate change. It's the loss of most of the species we've evolved here with. It's very sad. And the only thing I'll say in the ending of it, psychologically, I know why people aren't making these big topics of conversation is, it's too depressing.
Yeah, well, it is. It's overwhelming, I think.
It is.
All right, Gary, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks. All right. So Gary brought up this report that was all over the news yesterday. A new UN report is warning that humans are threatening their own futures by accelerating the extinction of more than a million species. And the report says that nature's current rate of decline is unparalleled, and the accelerating rate of extinctions means grave impacts on people around the world are now likely. The UN report also says it's not too late to fix the problem. But pretty interesting report, widely reported yesterday by newspapers. extinction of a million species of plants and animals on the planet is on the horizon. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Mark from Brandon writes, it was great having an actual lawmaker on your show. Gives us an inside and up-to-date view of what really goes on in Tallahassee. Please have her back, writes Mark. Thank you for that. And then Anonymous from the 813 area code says that President Trump's approval numbers, according to Gallup, are up to 46%. Yeah, they are. And that was a survey taken up to April 30th. We don't know what's happened in the last few days, but you're right. Up to April 30th, President Trump's approval numbers, according to Gallup, were up to 46%. What do you think? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Tina in Tampa. Tina, you're on M&F. What would you like to say?
I'll make a couple of comments on the Mueller report, but the Section 1, what they call Section 1, what the Russians did, I really want to urge people to read it. It is, it's not that long. It's not that complicated. The only thing that makes it a little difficult is that there are so many redactions that, you know, you kind of jump around. You read about what these two Russians are doing, and then the entire page will be redacted, and then you pick up and you're in a different circumstance. But I read what I could of it, and it really made me angry. And we have heard bits and pieces of what went on as these Russians have been indicted and as other people have been indicted, but nothing will really get the point quite across the extent of what Putin and that government, if you want to call it a government, what they did to this country, like reading it yourself. What they did, what they called what they did to this country, information warfare. That is what they, in Russia, entitled it. And it was planned. They started in 2014. They tried to get four people into this country. They managed to get two, because I guess they had to go through some type of State Department security pass, and they got two of them in. And they started right away. Organizing and starting groups on Facebook and having rallies. I mean, they organized groups called, for example, this is some of the fake names: Black Fist, United in Favor, United for Strong Borders. That's just a couple of names that I remember. But these are front groups; they're fake groups, and in a lot of cases, they held rallies. They had followers. Some of these groups had upwards of 300,000 followers, and the whole point is just to go into this great disinformation campaign and to stir people up and create misimpressions. And they certainly seem to have achieved what they wanted, because the level of hostility in this country is, what I can see is quite high.
And Tina, when the president said after his hour and a half talk with President Putin of Russia last week that he didn't bring up this topic, and you're right. I mean, the second sentence in the executive summary of the Mueller report about Russia is the Russian government interfered in the 2016 presidential election in sweeping and systematic fashion. A pretty strong indictment.
Oh, yeah.
Right there. So when the president said that he didn't bring this issue up last week when he talked with President Putin, what do you make of that?
I think that it is the most inept and un-American thing. For him to say that, he's, you know, I don't think his, and I think a lot of people feel this way, I certainly have, I don't think his sense of reality, he sees things as he wants them to be, not as they are. That is why it is so important that Congress pursue this, get Mueller to testify. People need to listen to what he says. People need to describe it. President Trump, if anybody is on the fence about whether they're going to vote for him, and I heard you mention his poll numbers are going up, God knows why, but if anybody is on the fence about whether to vote for him, know this. President Trump knows nothing about being an American. He knows nothing about this nation's history, and even less about our Constitution. And I'll read it. People can download it from the Washington Post. It's or you can read it online. You don't have to download it. and it'll make you angry.
Yeah. All right. Tina, okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. And if you're friends with me on Facebook, I posted a link to the two executive summaries of the Mueller report. The one covers Russian interference in the election, and the second covers a possible obstruction of justice by the by President Trump. So if you're friends with me on Facebook, it's right there at the top of my list. Jeff in Newport Richey writes, liberals have decided that the sea will be devoid of fish in 45 years, even though global warming is going to end the world in 12 or 10, depending on which liberal you ask. So is Jeff in Newport Richey questioning whether or not the warnings about global warming are true. The global warming is not going to end the earth. Global warming could put an end, I think, to much of life as we know it and make it really hard for humans and many species to exist because of the giant storms, because of the sea level rise, because of increased tornado activity, increased drought activity, increased rainfall, where rainfall's already there. But global warming is not going to end the planet. The planet will still be here, Jeff. But Jeff, thanks a lot. And the part about fish is that, as we know, there's a lot of pollution going into the oceans, especially toxic chemical pollution and plastic pollution going into the oceans. So, yes, the fish species around the oceans are in danger only because of the enormous amount of pollution that we're pumping into the oceans. But, Jeff, thank you for your comments. We're going to go back to the phones. We got one open line you'll be able to get through right away. It is 813-239-9663. And thanks to Frank Knox and Jan Simpson, both personing the phones in the back. Let's go to Lev in St. Petersburg. Lev, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hello. Yes, my call is in response to the gentleman. He was asking why he thinks, they're wondering why people aren't talking about the important conversations. And I have wondered about this quite a bit myself, and I stumbled on a book by a guy named Derek Jensen. The book is called The Language Before Words. And it speaks about, basically, we're all in this paralyzed state of denial, essentially, because like he said, it's just too much to take in. But he made this interesting connection between kind of the way that we're treating the planet and the land, and the way, I believe, the author himself went through a history of rape that he talks about in the book. And the way that that correlates to kind of this sort of culture of denial around, you know, what's happened to the marginalized populations in our country. And it's kind of a sad book that leaves on a sad note. So I was happy to find another book called Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein that talks about kind of creating a new story of connecting to all that grief, all that pain, and then using that, even that hate, you know, and using that to create a new world where we're connecting and integrating and really bringing it out into the open, which I think really is the most important thing, just getting out into the open all of these issues we have so we can just see what's on the table, what we can, you know, how we can deal with all of this. So I just wanted to give you those two resources, Derek Jensen and Charles Eisenstein, both great authors that talk a lot about this issue of denial of the past and how we could get back to dealing with the real issues.
All right, Lev, thanks for those suggestions.
All right.
I know there's a lot of Derek Jensen fans here in the Tampa Bay area. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. DeMarco writes this, Trump is the epitome of the ugly American, writes DeMarco. And he goes on to say he's ripped the mask right off the U.S. and made the U.S. a pariah on the world stage, just at the point in world history where we have a decade to deny it with other countries to preserve the Earth as a livable planet for our children and theirs. Trump, or Twitter, as DeMarco calls him, is the crookedest president ever, and Democrats have no choice but to impeach him. We must stop his subversion of U.S. democracy and the rule of law in our country, writes DeMarco. Okay, that's DeMarco's opinion. What's your opinion? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Jack in Palm Harbor writes, what happened to the Republicans of yesterday? Republicans did not have blinders during the Nixon years. Nixon did half as much as what is going on now, writes Jack in Palm Harbor. Let's go to Teresa in St. Petersburg. Hi, Teresa, you're on MNF.
Hi. The Republicans would only care about the Mueller report if it was Hillary. They would be, she'd probably be already impeached for whatever reason they would come up with.
What do you think the worst part of what you've read in the Mueller report or what you know about the Mueller report, what's the worst action the president took?
Well, for me, it's just of what the Russians did, and for all the all his campaign people meeting with all these Russians, I can't understand how this meeting with them should have been conspiracy. Paul Manafort gave them polling information. Isn't that I have the report and I've been reading it, but I don't understand how that can't be collusion or whatever you want to call it. I'm just not understanding how. So, you know, I think we just need to hear from Mr. Mueller.
And
the obstruction is he asked these people that are around him to go, you know, he obstructed the investigation, fire that person, say this, do this. On national TV, he said he fired Comey because of the Russia thing. So how that's not obstruction of justice, I don't know, but, you know, because they can't indict a sitting president.
And when Mitch McConnell says later today that the case is closed, now that we've got the Mueller report out, what would you say back to Senator McConnell?
I would say, no, it's not. You are protecting a traitor to this country. And that makes those Republicans in the Senate a traitor to this country and the ones in the House a traitor to this country. We don't know if he is conspiring with Putin now. He met him secretly. We don't know what was said or what's going on.
All right,
so,
Teresa.
I just feel they're all un-American and they're all traitors to this country. That's just the way I feel right now.
Of course. All right, Teresa, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. And we got one open line, 813-239-9663. And it looks like that problem with line number one has come back, too. We had that problem yesterday. Let's go to Al in St. Pete. Al, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
I'm kind of amazed this hasn't come up. I see the man as the Antichrist, and the other guy is the other side of the same coin, Putin.
And why do you think that Trump is the Antichrist?
Well, because everything he does is toward the negative. I mean, what does a man do to a positive form? He's just a big void, a hole that's never full.
Okay, all right. I mean, what was that movie from the 70s, Damien?
Yeah, it might have been him.
Yeah, all right. Well, Al, thank you. Thank you for your comments.
That's my opinion. A little over the top, but so it be.
All right, Al, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to John in St. Pete. John, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, I'm just curious as to who says you can't indict a sitting president and why?
That was an issue that came up years ago. The Justice Department issued a report, an opinion back then, but it's really never been tested at the Supreme Court level. But that is kind of a rule that's been followed for years. But it's not really been tested before the Supreme Court, although you probably don't want to test it in front of this Supreme Court because they're likely to side with President Trump.
Well, I just am wondering, you know, why not take it to the court and have a final say on this? Because you're going to always leave this open to interpretation, and any president can do anything he wants.
Is it dangerous if we assume that the president is protected from indictment? Is it dangerous for democracy to allow that protection to say, well, there's one person in the entire country you cannot touch with the rule of law, and that is the president? Is that dangerous for democracy?
We've all been taught that no one is above the law. That's what we've all been taught in school. No one is above the law. So he has to be able to be indicted. If he was to shoot somebody, he used to brag he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would still be with him.
Mm-hmm.
Is this true? Could he molest a child and it would be okay? Would it be up to Mitch McConnell to remove him?
Well, I think you raise a really great point. I mean, why would any human being, if we live in a democracy, why would any human being be above the law and be protected until they leave office?
Correct. And yeah. I also have a question about the Mueller experience. Didn't Trump say something like, "Oh my God, this is the end of my presidency," and he used an expletive?
Yep.
Why would your reaction be that when a special prosecutor is appointed? Why would that be your reaction if you are innocent? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's telling.
All right.
I mean, to any listener.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
John, thanks a lot. All right. So what do you think? 813-239-9663. Anonymous from the 239 area code writes back to one of our listeners. Anonymous writes, please tell your listener, Jeff in Newport Richey, to stop regurgitating lies and actually educate himself on something like the fact that it was a Republican consultant named Frank Luntz who changed the name from global warming to climate change. That's the 239 area code writing anonymously. Thanks, 239. Gary writes this. I know I will learn this when I read the report, but for the listeners, are the section summaries in the report redacted so they could have been used by Barr and released quickly? Just wondering if they could be more easily read than the redacted full report, Gary writes. I've only read the summaries. I've not read the full report. So I can't tell you how they're split up, but there are a lot of redactions, as Tina said, in the even in the summaries, Gary. Let's go back to the phones. We're going to go to Rod in Largo. Rod, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
I think this whole thing is a joke. Like I said, if there was nothing to worry about in the report, then why wouldn't you let it go? If you're innocent and you haven't done anything, then why would you just put it out there and let them make the decisions on their own?
And have Mueller testify, too, right? Have Mueller testify about the report, because if it clears you, then you want Mueller to testify.
That's what one would think if one was innocent. And then it's just like you said about the obstruction. He instructed all those people to lie, to not go in and testify, to give them wrong information, and how is that not obstruction? And we're only seeing the redacted portion of it and being able to read that. You and I hit on it. If there's something to worry about, then why wouldn't you want it out there?
Yeah, and Mueller didn't say it cleared him. He just said that he couldn't make that determination. He did on the question of obstruction.
Well, and I believe Trump, I saw on the news the other day, he's put over 100 judges in the court since he's been in. I think it just topped 100 that count, the lifetime appointments. And I believe the Republicans, it seems like for many years, the Republicans haven't been able to win legitimately, so they have to do the voter suppression. I don't believe they're going to do anything about Russia, too, because it's helping them.
Well, that's a scary thought. All right. Rod, thanks a lot. Thank you. I mean, if the Mueller report, and it does say that Russia influenced in a very wide-ranging and deliberate way, you would think that Congress would want to take up that issue and protect the voting systems of the country and protect people from being influenced by Russians. And the other question that we don't know is which Florida county? We know one Florida county was hacked. The system, voting system, was hacked by the Russians. Well, which county was it? Let's go to Jim in Bradenton. Jim, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Yeah, the 2020 election is going to be critical in the history of this country and the history of the world. If we don't make a change at the top, we're screwed.
And Jim, what would you say to those 46% of the country, though, that support President Trump?
Well, you know, Democrats have to get out and vote. And I will vote for whoever gets a Democratic nomination. My personal dream ticket would be Bernie Sanders for president, Beto O'Rourke for vice president.
You don't think that we need a woman somewhere in there or a person of color?
I think those would be the two that would be able to get into the ring with Trump, knock him out, and set this country back on the right path.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks. Let's go to John in Port Richey. John, we just have 30 seconds.
Hey, real quick question. Wasn't it in the report or heard somebody say that Trump tried to conspire with the Russians, but it was staff members that curbed that thought or activity?
No, I don't think that was in there. It looks like he tried to obstruct justice by ordering the firing of several people, and his wishes were not carried out by his staff. That's why it's so important that Don McGahn be able to testify.
Okay, so it was the obstruction. My misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And for the 46%, great propaganda machine there, Sean Hannity.
All right, John. Thanks a lot, John. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. In fact, in the next hour, your hero Mark Bureau is likely to take up some of these topics. So stick around for Mark Bureau's show. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for listening. Here's the news from NPR.